Ambry presents Next and Now, a podcast on all things genetic.
Welcome, everyone, to the Basics of Inborn Errors of Metabolism webinar. Today's educational event will be an overview of the basics of inborn errors of metabolism from a clinical perspective, and we will explore some of the more commonly associated pediatric disorders. Our speaker, Dr. Samantha Vergano, is the Division Director of Medical Genetics and Metabolism at the Children's Hospital of the King's Daughters in Norfolk, Virginia. Dr. Vergano's clinical expertise is in the area of urea cycle disorders and hyperammonemia in neonates, Marfan syndrome, and related connective tissue disorders and skeletal dysplasias. She is certified by the American Board of Medical Genetics and American Board of Pediatrics, and completed her fellowship at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Also, we have had this webinar approved by the NSGC for CEUs, so if you are requesting CEUs for this event, please make sure to complete the SurveyMonkey survey that will automatically pop up on your screen as you exit the webinar. So I will turn this over now to Dr. Vergano for the basics of inborn errors of metabolism. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Stephanie. Many thanks for the opportunity to talk to you all today about biochemical disorders. This is certainly not an exhaustive presentation. You could give days of talks about inborn errors, but I'm going to try and touch on some of the major diseases, briefly touch on management as well, and then talk about some of the diagnostics. So this is a picture of apparently all the pathways in the cell, and if you try to memorize this in an effort to learn biochemical genetics, it's likely that your head would explode. So that's why I'm just going to go through some basics, and if anyone has questions at the end about more specific diseases or things, we can certainly talk about that. I'm also going to try and intersperse some levity into what can potentially be a boring topic, so I'm going to ask some random trivia questions throughout the presentation. If you know the answer, great. If you don't, then you're going to learn some random trivia. So the first question is, can a human spontaneously combust? We'll find out about that on the next slide. So people think about metabolic pathways in different ways, just depending on how their brain works. The way I'm going to categorize them today is based on groups of diseases. There are a lot of them, and I'm certainly not going to talk about all of them, but the groups that I'm going to try and cover are, in general, amino acid disorders, which include some of the organic acidurias, disorders that are derived from branched-chain amino acids, and then phenylalanine hydroxylase deficiency, which is now the new name for PKU, phenylketonuria. We're going to talk a little bit about urea cycle disorders and disorders of nitrogen metabolism. Talk about galactose, galactosemia, those disorders. I'm going to briefly talk about glucose metabolism, and these disorders that I'm going to talk about are only a small part of the this category, so that can obviously be a long talk as well. And then we're going to talk about fatty acid oxidation defects, which is one of the more common categories of disorders that geneticists and genetic counselors may encounter. There are other groups, which I'm not going to talk about today. Some of those include the vitamin-responsive disorders, such as biotinidase deficiency, the cobalaminopathies, tyrosinemia, which is not uncommon either, but I'm not going to go down that route today, and then some other more esoteric type things. Some people will also put storage disorders, lysosomal storage disorders, in this category of metabolic pathways. Again, that can be a lecture into itself, so while I give it a nod in terms of it being a biochemical group, I'm not going to touch base on that today. And then we'll talk briefly about how you can do biochemical testing to diagnose these diseases, as well as some molecular testing. So the answer to the human combustion thing is that humans can sort of spontaneously combust. the combustion has happened, but scientists feel that there's probably an underlying cause in each case which hasn't necessarily been recognized, so don't worry about it. So some general principles when you think about biochemical disorders and how they work. There's really three problems that are the root of most metabolic disorders. Either you're lacking enough substrate to complete the reaction, you're lacking an enzyme, which is necessary for the reaction to complete, and you get buildup of a precursor, or you're lacking a cofactor or an aid to complete the reaction. So the best analogy that I can think of to explain this is, if anyone's familiar with the Holland Tunnel in New York, it's a very busy tunnel. So if the Holland Tunnel needed repairs and they needed to collect tolls to make those repairs, but they couldn't get enough money, it can be because of three reasons. So either there aren't enough cars going through the tunnel to collect the needed money for tolls. So here there's only two cars. You may not have something within the tunnel working, so you have a block or an accident, which causes a typical New York crunch, and then you don't get the cars going through the tunnel to get the tolls. Or there may be something wrong with the toll machine itself. This is not in New York, but so if the toll, everything else is working, if the cars are going through and the tunnel is working, but you just don't have the end result of collecting the money. That's kind of how I looked at it. Some more general principles regarding testing. So these are biochemical tests that are generally ordered at first glance when you see a child that in whom you suspect an inborn error. And I'll just talk about basically what these mean. So plasma amino acids are often ordered. And the way I think about that is, this is a test that basically looks at the building blocks of protein in an individual's body. So they can either be used for diagnostic purposes, seeing if particular amino acids are low or are in excess. And they can also be used for monitoring. So if you have a child that's on a protein-restricted diet, you want to make sure that they still have the right amount of protein and the right distribution of the amino acids. So that's something we'll look for. So plasma amino acids are helpful, particularly in urea cycle defects, and you can see some abnormalities in the organic acidurias and some other disorders. Plasma acyl carnitine profiles are also a commonly ordered test. This is really the test to look at the fats in the body. They are reported out in terms of length of carbon species of the fatty acids. And so when you see a report, it'll give you levels of C0, C2, C6, C8, C10, that kind of thing. And then diseases can be diagnosed based on, again, either absent levels or very high levels, indicating some disorder with fatty acid oxidation. You can also use it for diagnosing carnitine deficiency, and then they're often abnormal slightly in certain other disorders. Urine organic acids is kind of a mix of the two. It looks at intermediary metabolites from both fats and protein. It can also indicate if an individual is in ketosis and if there are some other metabolites that are excreted in particular disorders like glutaric aciduria or things like that. There's also a test called urine amino acids, and it often gets confused with organic acids. And some departments, non-genetic departments, will order urine amino acids, and I'm not quite sure if they mean organics or if there's something else they're looking for. But I was taught that urine amino acids are really only useful if you're considering some really strange disorders, including lysinuric protein intolerance, in which you have an elevated citrulline level, or triple H syndrome. It's really not useful for some of the basic inborn errors that you may deal with. Doesn't mean you can't order it. It just may give you some abnormal result that you have nothing, that you have no idea what to do with. There are also what I'm referring to as basic labs that are enzyme or metabolite specific. I'm going to go back to urine isoglycines. And these are really for if you're looking for an accumulation of a particular protein, like in tyrosinemia. If you're worried about homocystinuria, you're going to get a homocysteine level. If you're worried about galactosemia in a baby, you're going to get Gal-1P levels, and we'll talk about that a little later. Going back up to urine, so urine acylglycines are a test that also look at intermediates, and they're usually helpful with some of the fatty acid oxidation disorders, particularly MCAD, they'll be abnormal in, and then some other fatty acid disorders they're not helpful in, like VLCAD, the longer chain ones. So we'll touch base a little bit about that. So typically, when newborn screening is done in your state, they will do mass spec and other tests that essentially mimic these. So they'll do plasma amino acid, sort of. They'll sort of do an acyl carnitine profile, but it's not labeled as that. And then they obviously don't test urine, but this is kind of, if you think of it as these are the tests that are being looked at to determine those disorders that are tested for in your state. There's a really good chart in the most recent Sauterbray edition that talks about newborn screening and the possible abnormalities you might see, and then what tests you either need to order or what the abnormality would be. So there's a whole section. I put pages 78 to 94 because there's some text in there too, but the on page 79 itself, there's a really good chart, which I think might be helpful when you think about these things. Just a word about inheritance. Pretty much almost all metabolic diseases are autosomal recessive. You're probably taught in genetic counseling school and med school and all those things that if it's weird and it's rare, it's probably autosomal recessive, which is good because that means that most people live if they're a carrier of it. There are some forms of metabolic disease where they're seeing some autosomal dominant patterns. I think there's an autosomal dominant type of 3MCC syndrome disease, but for the most part, if you're going between one choice and the other, it's autosomal recessive. And speaking of heredity, the second question is it really true that Jamie Lee Curtis has androgen insensitivity? And you'll read all over the place that maybe she's actually XY or she's XXY or whatever. But apparently, no one really knows. At least that's what I gathered. And she doesn't talk about it. So I'm not sure if that was an urban myth or where that spawned. But, you know, don't bring it up with her if you ever talk to her. So I'm going to start with some of the amino acid disorders. And this picture up here is the metabolism of the branch chain amino acids, so leucine, isoleucine, and valine. And a lot of the organic acidurias and leucine disorders obviously derive from defects in these enzymes. So we're going to talk specifically about propionic acidemia and methylmalonic acidemia. And I'm going to use the term acidemia and aciduria interchangeably. I don't know exactly what the difference is, but for all intents and purposes, it doesn't matter. And so defects lead to the inability to produce succinyl-CoA, which then goes into the Krebs cycle or the citric acid cycle. So that's where the problem lies, is obviously an inability to do part of the cell's energy. And the leucine degradation pathway is obviously from leucine, and there are several disorders. Pretty much all of these enzymes can have a disorder associated with them. We're going to talk about I'm not really going to talk about IVA other than to say that it's part of the leucine degradation pathway, 3-MCC or 3-methylcrotonyl carboxylase deficiency, and the HMG-CoA lyase and synthase diseases. 3-methylglutaconic aciduria is one of the types of, well, is essentially Barth syndrome, which is that X-linked cardiomyopathy disorder, but I'm not going to really touch base about that. So the first thing actually I'm going to talk about is phenylalanine hydroxylase deficiency, a.k.a. PKU, which people still call it that. And this is probably the prototypical metabolic disorder that most people think of. So I just wanted to talk about that briefly. So this is the test that was the first test on metabolic screening. Newborn screening in the United States is 50 years old this year. And this is why people still sometimes refer to it as the PKU test, even though PKU is obviously not the only disease that is looked at. So the problem in this disorder is you have an enzyme deficiency of phenylalanine hydroxylase, which is why I guess they changed the name. It leads to a backup of phenylalanine. So like in that analogy, there's a problem with the tunnel and the cars are backed up into traffic. And phenylalanine is neurotoxic. Before newborn screening, this disorder was quite devastating, and it will lead to microcephaly and severe cognitive impairment, such that individuals are not really able to function in society. Now that it's on the newborn screen, that's sort of revolutionized the way we think about metabolic disease and treat it. For these children who have this disorder, they will often have to take a particular type of formula that's restricted in phenylalanine, but replete in the other amino acids that are necessary for growth and development. And then besides the formula, they need to adhere to a phenylalanine-restricted diet. Usually that pretty much means that they're going to be vegetarians. This is not one of these disorders that in times of stress will create metabolic decompensation or acidosis. It's sort of more of a diet disorder, if you want to think about it that way. The children, if they ate a cheeseburger, they would not become, hopefully, acutely ill and need some emergency management. It's really just an accumulation of problems over time when the body is exposed to elevated levels of phenylalanine, if you're treated. So this is from this website, babiesfirsttest.org, and it just talks a little bit about newborn screening and educating the public about why we do it and what kind of things are tested. And really the big thing about PKU is that it literally took people who would have been previously institutionalized for their significant cognitive deficits, and now these are normal, healthy people who grow up, contribute to society, have families, have lives, and it's really been, like I said, it's sort of revolutionized the way we think about these severe disorders. Depending on how tight an individual's control is, with their diet, there can still be some learning delays, and there are several studies that have looked at the degrees of IQ that will drop if your levels are X for whatever period of time. Typically, the normal levels of Phe that we like to have phenylketonurics at are 3 to maybe 5, but some people live with levels of 14 if they don't adhere to the diet, but that doesn't mean that they're going to like die the next day. But there may be significant learning differences. In regards to being pregnant, if you have PKU, you will not pass on PKU to your child unless, of course, your partner is a carrier as well and you give that gene. But because phenylalanine is neurotoxic, if a pregnant woman's control is not good, that phenylalanine will become a teratogen to the fetus. And so you can have PKU teratogenicity, where the baby is born with microcephaly and cardiac defects, and it's really quite bad. So when you are pregnant, we like to have really, really tightly controlled levels between 2 and 4, at least 6 months before conception. So if a woman is not on birth control, or even is, we like to make sure that they know what diet to have, know what to eat and not to eat if, say, they get morning sickness and things like that, so that they're kind of prepared. So some general principles about amino acid disorders, going back up to the original flow. Typically, amino acid disorders are the disorders that will result in metabolic acidosis, ketosis, significant decompensation in the face of catabolism. So anything that's going to rev up your metabolism, like being sick, vomiting, having surgery, being pregnant, all those things can either unmask a disorder or certainly make it worse. And most often the treatment for these are, in general, a restricted diet where you restrict the offending amino acid and then have a formula to provide the remaining needed protein for your body, and then sometimes additional medications which may be needed to help with control. And if you want to think about it in two ways, most often there's a severe neonatal presentation where a child is floridly ill shortly after birth, after starting any sort of a feed. And then sometimes there's a milder adult onset of these conditions, which either it truly is an adult onset or it's unmasked because of something else going on. So that's how you can think about those in general. Propionyl-CoA carboxylase deficiency is propionic aciduria, and then methylmalonyl-CoA mutase deficiency is methylmalonic aciduria, so PAMMA, it's easier to say. And what we're taught often, the mnemonic for remembering the the offending amino acids for these particular disorders is vomit. So you want a diet and formula that's restricted in valine, odd-chain fatty acids, methionine, isoleucine, and threonine, because some of these will feed into this pathway, and then you get more stress on little enzyme. So if you want to think about it that way. So PAMMA, we talked about what enzymes are affected here. Again, often a severe neonatal presentation that may present prior to your newborn screen coming back, depending on how fast your turnaround time is. They can get acidotic and sick during intercurrent illnesses. They do need a restricted diet, and each one, both of them actually use the same formula. And then there are some extra metabolic manifestations that you can worry about. In PA, certainly cardiomyopathy is a concern and sometimes is inevitable depending on how good your control is. Pancreatitis is a big thing, especially for MMA. And then for both disorders, sometimes you can get neutropenia, seizures, developmental delays, things like that. There are individuals with PA and MMA who do quite well cognitively, and there are some that, depending on the severity of their neonatal presentation, if they had one, are quite delayed. So I'm going to move on to maple syrup urine disease, which a lot of people have heard of because of its name. It's technically a deficiency of branched-chain ketodehydrogenase deficiency. So this is one of the prototypical leucine degradation disorders, and the enzyme is here. So you get a buildup of leucine. Again, leucine in excess is neurotoxic, so the goal is to reduce this substrate so you don't put more stress on an enzyme which is deficient. And ultimately, this is also going to go down to provide metabolites for the Krebs cycle. So the next question is, speaking of maple syrup, was Aunt Jemima real? Real person. More about maple syrup urine disease. So actually, the first thing that's affected with the smell is earwax, but most neonatologists or pediatricians don't go around testing babies' earwax. And so usually the first thing that will manifest is the smell to the urine, which gave it its name. It can present with a severe neonatal encephalopathy, which obviously requires intervention. And this, too, requires a particular diet. This is one brand of the formulas that they use that are restricted in the branched-chain amino acids. You'll often want to get plasma amino acids as a monitoring tool, as we mentioned before, to look at the leucine levels, particularly in the times of illness. And then when a child is ill, you really want to make sure that they're able to take their formula, that they're not vomiting or dehydrated, and they will often need to come into the hospital and may need fluids or just making sure that they're taking in what they need to. Like a lot of other metabolic disorders, an orthotopic liver transplant is considered quote-unquote curative. You will still have the disorder in the rest of the cells of your body, but your liver, which produces the most of all these reactions, is not affected by it. So that sort of tempers it. It doesn't undo anything that has been affected in terms of cognitive function, but it prevents further sort of crises. So Jemima, the figure was apparently real, but her name wasn't Jemima, and I don't know what the real name is, but I guess she was a woman that made syrup or pancakes. So more in this leucine degradation pathway, as I said, all these enzymes can be affected, and I'm just going to mention that they include HMG-CoA lyase deficiency as well as HMG-CoA synthase deficiency. Synthase deficiency is pretty rare, but there are multiple individuals with HMG-CoA lyase deficiency. They, too, have to have a diet restricted in leucine and will have supplementary formula, and they can also decompensate during illness, so you want to be extra vigilant about those kids. 3-MCC deficiency, 3-methylcrotonyl carboxylase deficiency, is kind of a plus-minus disease. There are certainly individuals who have it who are at risk for either decompensation or acidosis when they're ill, or may kind of tip over easily. People refer to that. And then there are some individuals who go through their entire life asymptomatic and never have a problem. So pretty wide range of presentation. But this is one of the, at least in Virginia, this is one of the disorders that's screened for on newborn screening, and I think in most of the other states as well, because you do want to identify those children in the event that for some reason they get sick out of proportion to their illness. Glutaric aciduria type 1, I'm going to talk about now. It's sort of an organic aciduria in that it involves glutarate and that sort of pathway, but it doesn't present like the other organic aciduras. There is no neonatal illness, no overwhelming kind of disease that is obvious in the neonatal period. Rather, these kids may have a large head size at birth, and then usually around, so like 6 months of age is probably like the most vulnerable period, at least from what I remember. And then if they get ill with anything, it can precipitate this metabolic crisis, which can lead to a variety of symptoms, including subdural hemorrhage, which is often obviously devastating. And the problems in the brain center around the basal ganglia, which are the parts of the brain that are responsible for movement in the body. So often these children will end up having significant dystonia or chorea, and they'll have delays as a result of these crises, which can occur anytime they get ill. So it's sort of a cumulative effect of how devastated they may ultimately get. And their head size will increase. So if you see a rapidly increasing head size, you know, that's obviously some concern. This, too, is managed with a restricted diet and formula. One of the brand names is Glutarex. I think Ross makes that. This is one of these diseases that should be on the differential for non-accidental trauma, because obviously a subdural hemorrhage in a child is not normal. And unfortunately, most of the time it is non-accidental trauma. But in those rare cases, it can be a metabolic disorder, and that should be looked into certainly before you make a decision about you know, any sort of social situations, et cetera. This is just a little figure and an MRI. So the basal ganglia and the related structures around it, that's what this is showing here, is the increased signal intensity after, after I assume, some sort of crisis. So prevalence, these, like most metabolic disorders, are pretty rare, at least 1 in 100,000, some much rarer, but like also a lot of other genetic disorders, they are higher in prevalence in particular populations. Although Ashkenazi Jews are usually affected with the brunt of genetic disorders, this is not really their group of diseases, fortunately, because we have enough problems. So tyrosinemia, you can see in French Canadians. Glutaric aciduria type 1 and MSUD, you can see more in the Amish. The Clinic for Special Children in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, does a lot of research on these particular disorders because they occur in their community population, which is the Amish. and I'm not promoting them in any way, just sort of letting you know that they're out there. So the Amish, they obviously intermarry and have a higher rate of these disorders. So related to the Amish, what does the term Rumspringa mean? And if anyone's watched that show, Breaking Amish, which I'm not really sure if it's real, it talks about this time in adolescence where the community will allow the teen to go off and party or do whatever they kind of want to. That's not accepted generally in their culture, and it sort of gives them the opportunity to decide if they want to return to the church or if they want to join the rest of America. And it's German kind of, or it's Pennsylvania Dutch for running around. Okay, I'm going to move on to another broad category of urea cycle disorders, which represents a good group of disorders that will affect your patients if you treat inborn errors. It revolves primarily around the excretion of nitrogen in the form of urea and essentially ammonia. So the ultimate problem with these disorders is that you can't complete the cycle and you have a buildup of ammonia, which, like everything else we've talked about, is neurotoxic. So the prototypical presentation is a 2 to 3 day old baby boy who has been discharged from the nursery, comes back to the ER. The parents say that he's lethargic. He's really not nursing all that well. He feels cold, or perhaps they saw seizures. Really not acting himself. And what's happening in that situation is their urea cycle has, the urea cycle that they had before when they were in mom was part of mom, and now that they're outside of mom, their urea cycle is forced to work, and it doesn't. So they get hyperammonemic, and they basically act intoxicated. These children are often thought to have sepsis, and because it's such a rare disorder, people don't look for it in the ER. It's not their fault. It's just a very rare thing. And so by the time you get an ammonia level after you've done your septic workup, it's generally too late to make any sort of a difference in cognitive outcome. So my big beef is that if a child comes into the ER and they're between 2 to 10 days of age and they do not look right, the differential diagnosis is not sepsis, it's sepsis inborn error, because you really have to think about it, and obviously if you don't think about it, you're not going to test for it. So getting an ammonia on these children can potentially save their life and some cognitive function. So that's kind of my soapbox, and I'll get off of it. There's the neonatal catastrophic illness that can present. There's also a teen onset that sometimes you'll see. The vignette will be that you have a 13-year-old who tried out for the football team, and he took a whole bunch of those protein shakes in an effort to build up his muscles, and he's brought to the ER by his parents because he, too, is acting intoxicated, altered mental status, not himself at all. So in that case, they may have a mutation that gives them a little bit more enzyme than the neonate, so they're not completely depleted, and they've gone through their entire life functioning on what they have. But when you stress the system with too much protein, their urea cycle can't handle it, and so that's what gets unmasked. And again, any other sort of catabolic processes like pregnancy, sometimes women carriers will be unmasked during pregnancy because it is such a metabolic stress. And you can have women go into hyperammonemic comas after childbirth, and you would have no reason to diagnose them with a urea cycle defect before if you weren't thinking of it. So that's unfortunately something that can happen too. Essentially, the treatment is lifelong protein restriction, again, in the form of a restricted diet and formula supplementation. We will also often give these children nitrogen scavengers, medications like Bufenyl or the new drug Ravicti, which is a kind of like an isomer of that, or as well as like arginine and other parts of the urea cycle, so that they can complete the cycle after the after the area of deficit. So just to go back and show you. So if you have obviously a defect here in this enzyme, OTC, you're going to get very little of what's upstream. So you get very low citrulline, which you then may need to supplement them with. And you'll get a buildup of carbamyl phosphate, which then gets changed to orotic acid. And orotic acid is a test that you can do on urine, and it's often ordered at the time of when you're working up a kit for urea cycle disorder, because it will help you determine where in the urea cycle the defect is. Namely, if it's more proximal, you're not going to get the buildup of orotic acid, and if it's more distal, you will. So sometimes that helps with that. And again, I'm telling you these things not that I expect you to memorize exactly how to work them up, and in fact, you may never need to work them up, but just sort of so you get an idea of how they work and how you can think about these things. So the one specific urea cycle disorder I'm going to talk about today is ornithine transcarbamylase deficiency, again, appropriately abbreviated as OTC. This is the most common urea cycle disorder. Again, these are very rare, but this is the most common of them. It is X-linked. But women can be affected. So the classic presentation you'll hear is maybe a woman who has essentially been healthy her whole life, but she often gets migraines. She may self-restrict protein, so she'll say that she really doesn't eat beef because it makes her feel ill. And so she's a, you know, she's a vegetarian or whatever. And sometimes also they may have what's referred to as frontal lobe deficits, so deficits in judgment, some behavioral differences. So, and again, this is not a stereotype, but sometimes these women will have a pattern of like unstable relationships or that kind of thing. And that's because they have a decrease in their enzyme enough to give them some sort of symptoms, but certainly not enough to present with some crisis. So the majority of women who are carriers are not symptomatic, but just because a woman is not symptomatic as a carrier doesn't mean that if she has a child, a girl who is a carrier, that they too will be asymptomatic. So it sort of changes through generations. Again, the neonatal presentation in a boy is unfortunately often lethal. They can have a hyperammonemic encephalopathy, which is severe. You can have ammonia levels in the thousands. A normal ammonia level from whatever lab you're looking at is generally something like 9 to 30 or some variant of that. In a newborn, it's not unusual to see it up to 100 just because it's hard to get blood out of an infant. So people will often, squeeze or use a tourniquet, which lyses the red blood cells and then drives up the ammonia level. So if you see a five-day-old and the ammonia is 80, yeah, that's high, but it's probably because they had trouble getting the blood. And the time you really worry is when it's like greater than 250 or something like that. Again, managed with protein restriction, a supplementary formula, and these nitrogen scavenging medications. Like we talked about for MSUD, the liver transplant is considered a cure. Only for the hyperammonemic episodes. So once they have a liver transplant, you don't worry about them coming in with an elevated ammonia level if they're sick, but they have all the complications of having had a liver transplant, and as I said before, it doesn't undo the cognitive issues, unfortunately. So some of the other urea cycle disorders are listed here, and I'm not going to go through the specifics of all of them other than to say that you should just maybe be familiar with their names. So the last question, well, not the last question, but this question is, did you know that if you give the United Mitochondrial Disease Foundation like a $20 donation, they will make you a mitochondrial Halloween costume so you can be the mockery of your residency class, or Jack Black doing it because he looks cool? So the answer to that is yes. Galactosemia is a very common disorder that's tested for on newborn screens, and you'll often get a lot of false positives. The classic galactosemia is a defect in the galactose-1-phosphate uridyl transferase, otherwise known as GALT enzyme. This enzyme, when it's not functioning, it prevents the proper breakdown of galactose into glucose. So the labs that you'll be looking at are a low GALT level, so a low enzyme level, and an elevated GAL1P, which is the precursor, so the traffic backing up into the tunnel. This, too, can present as a devastating illness, which is often not recognized. It can result in poor feeding, vomiting, jaundice, signs of liver dysfunction. And then the vignette that they always teach you is E. coli sepsis. That particular bacteria feeds on the galactose and its derivatives, so that's why you get that. These individuals need to have a restriction not only of lactose, but lactose-related products, ice cream, things like that. There are other foods that you wouldn't think would have galactose in them, like tomato sauce and chickpeas, and it used to be recommended that those also should be restricted, but they're finding that even in individuals, so between individuals who restrict those and those who do not, there really isn't any difference in their sort of lifetime outcome. Unfortunately for women, no matter how good you try and control your diet, they often will end up with premature ovarian failure. So that's an unfortunate side effect that still seems to happen no matter how quote-unquote good you are with your diet. And in neonates, we will often, unfortunately, have to put them on soy formula and ask a mom to either stop breastfeeding or limit it. But you also run into the possibility that if it's a false positive, you've stopped their opportunity to breastfeed. So it's good to remind the moms to pump if you have to switch the child to soy, but you're not sure of what's going on. Some other disorders in the galactosemia pathway include DG, which a lot of you probably have heard of. It's Duarte galactosemia. It's kind of a like a carrier state, but it's a more mild form. Different centers will differ on how they restrict lactose. Some will do a challenge at 6 months or 9 months with some sort of dairy product. Others will completely restrict until a year. There aren't really any good retrospective studies on individuals who have been treated either way. So it's sort of more right now of a physician preference, although some people will say otherwise. There's also epimerase deficiency or GALE deficiency, G-A-L-E. This too can present either as a severe illness or you can be completely asymptomatic. Some of the affected individuals have things that you wouldn't necessarily associate with this, like contractures and ligamentous laxity and things like that. What you look for on the screen is an elevated elevated G1P, like you do in the classic galactosemia, but your GALT levels are normal. And then GALK deficiency, GALK deficiency, I guess. Really the only consistent manifestation of that is nuclear cataracts in an infant. So anytime you see that, you should consider GALK kinase deficiency as a possible cause. And their lab values are elevated blood galactose. So not GAL1P, but blood galactose. So I think this is your last question. Do adults ever drink breast milk? Think on that. And the answer is yes. It's not only in China, but just for instance, in China, it's not uncommon for wealthy people to buy wet nurses so that they can have a supply of breast milk. And it's also felt to have some health benefits beyond infancy. Some people will claim that it's good for cancer treatment and things like that, but I don't know. To each his own. So this is the figure of glucose and galactose degradation. Here you have galactose, the galactic kinase enzyme. Again, this is why you test blood galactose, because this is the precursor. You have GAL1P and the GALT enzyme. So your GAL1P levels will be elevated if this enzyme is low, and you have low glucose 1-phosphate. And here's your epimerase. And so your GAL1P levels will be elevated with a pimerase deficiency, but because you're not utilizing this enzyme, that lab value doesn't really matter. It'll be normal. I'm going to touch really quickly about glycogen storage diseases because they too are a lecture into themselves. They basically involve defects in glycogen degradation, which leads to buildup in other organs. You can have hepatic types and muscle types, and there's now, I think, 13 different types. Some are mild and go undetected except in episodes of mild hypoglycemia. And then other ones are very severe, like Pompe disease, which is often fatal and results in cardiomegaly, hepatomegaly, macroglossia, things like that. And you can see that there are a variety of sort of extrahepatic manifestations as well. Glucose transporter deficiency type 1 or GLUT1 deficiency is a very rare disorder that most people are likely not to encounter, but it basically results in the body's inability to transport glucose into the brain. So affected individuals may have seizures, developmental delay, and then periods where they act drunk or act like their blood sugar is low, but their blood sugar is actually normal. And the way you can diagnose it is through a low glucose CSF. So if you remember nothing else about maybe this slide, just know that a CSF glucose less than 40 in the face of normal blood glucose is totally not good, and you should think about GLUT1 deficiency. And hopefully it won't be that, but at least you will have considered it. Okay, real quick about fatty acid oxidation disorders, because I know I'm towards the end of the period. General principles for these are that an individual have inability to process the fatty acids through the mitochondria, and ultimately they can't mobilize their glucose stores to get them through periods of fasting, or catabolism. So other manifestations that you may see in the more severe disorders are cardiomyopathies, rhabdo, and then for some of the shorter chain ones, you can have poor growth or failure to thrive or some mild developmental delays. This little figure just shows you the various types of fatty acid disorders as you go down the fatty acid pathway. So MCAT is medium chain, VLCAT is very long chain, LCAT is long chain, SCAT is short chain. TFP is trifunctional protein deficiency, which is essentially the most severe on the spectrum of fatty acid disorders. And the farther along you get, if you have a defect in that, it affects you more, obviously, because you have more more backing up. So I'm going to touch on MCAD really quickly because that's the most common. Prior to newborn screening, it was estimated to cause about maybe 10% of SIDS cases because babies would sleep through the night and not be able to tolerate that, and unfortunately they would wake up, deceased. So in periods of prolonged fasting, they can get hypoglycemia, acidosis. They can have like a rye type syndrome, like if you were to give a child aspirin, resulting in liver failure and then ultimately coma, which is not desired. So you try not to fast these children. VLCAD, very long chain. This can present in the neonatal period, or you can go asymptomatic. The one thing that you typically worry about is cardiomyopathy. You try and restrict these children from long chains, so they try and have a heart-healthy diet, and you may need to supplement with other oils or fats as you're restricting long-chain fats. There's also a formula that you can use, particularly when they're younger. I think the brand name is Monogen, but there are other types. Carnitine deficiencies are not considered fatty acid oxidation defects, but essentially result in the same issue of hypoglycemia and inability to mobilize glucose in periods of illness. So the carnitine helps transport into the mitochondria, and you can have a whole bunch of different ones. So primary carnitine deficiency, CACT is very rare. In the getting real cellular, in the outer mitochondrial membrane, you can have CPT1, you can have CPT2 in the inner membrane, you can have CACT, and then if you have just a low carnitine supply that's primary carnitine deficiency. Okay, so genetic testing, we talked about the biochemical testing that you can do, which is often the first line because it comes back more quickly, and it's, aside from a blood draw, fairly uninvasive. You can also look for particular enzymes if that's what you're worried about. So carboxylase activity for some of the disorders, particularly what I didn't talk about today, lysosomal enzymes, things like that. In addition, we said for specific disorders like homocystinuria or MMA, you can look for MMA levels in plasma and urine to see if those are elevated. If you need to do a skin biopsy, you can, and look for that in fibroblast enzyme activity in fibroblasts. And then if you think you know what's going on and you really need the gene mutation, there's obviously molecular analysis for that. You can either do single genes or most often available now is panels. So exome, I have to be honest, I'm not really familiar with exome for metabolic testing just yet, but I'm sure that it will become, as with the other genetic disorders, sort of part and parcel of what you do. I think it's probably useful when you have biochemical evidence of a disease, but you haven't found the gene, and you'll still treat the children the same way, but if you need to find that DNA, this exome may be useful. Again, it's not a first-line test because it costs a lot and takes a while to come back, but as technology improves, the turnaround time certainly will be better, as well as the accuracy. It also may be used if you're not quite sure what category of disorder you're looking at in a child, if some of the biochemical data is conflicting, or you have more than one thing going on, so a child with multiple congenital anomalies and evidence of a biochemical disorder, and again, atypical presentations of some of the metabolic diseases.
If you have any questions, feel free to email us. Thank you so much, Dr. Vergano, for your time today.
You're welcome.
And we look forward to seeing you guys again in our future webinars.
This has been an Ambry Genetics production of Next and Now. To learn more, visit ambrygen.com.